Good morning and welcome. My name is Peter Goslin, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Dr. Renee Goslin. Please join me in thanking our musicians today, Anna Matera Women's Chorus. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. As many of you know, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum programs are recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's talk may be heard on NHPR two Sundays from now at 10 p.m. The talk will also be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within a few days. After the presentation, in keeping with the Lyceum tradition, the speakers have agreed to answer questions from the audience. The ushers will be collecting your questions toward the end of the talk. Please write them on the yellow cards provided in your pews. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, and they may be placed in the glass bowls in the church and in the parish hall. Thank you for your generous support, and we want to especially thank today the Gilbert Verney Foundation for sponsoring Dr. Goslin's talk. Our speaker today is Dr. Renee Richardson Goslin, and her topic is a leadership issue, applying branding principles to combat unconscious bias. Renee Richardson Goslin is a Zenon Senados Career Development Assistant Professor of Marketing at the MIT Sloan School of Management. She has been named one of the world's top 40 professors under 40 and an MIT Iron Professor. Professor Goslin received her undergraduate and graduate training at Harvard University, including a doctorate from the Harvard Business School. Professor Goslin's research has been featured in academic journals, books, trade magazines, and the popular press. She regularly provides consulting to organizations on branding and related topics and is in high demand in these areas. Today, Professor Goslin will identify strategies that can help mindful leaders make authentic connections with various audiences, a key success factor for all organizations and the leaders who steer them. Also, Renee is a true blessing for me and my family, and we couldn't ask for a nicer, more genuine, intelligent, and caring daughter-in-law. It is an honor and a privilege for me to introduce to you Professor Renee Richardson Goslin.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming out and for opening your hearts and minds to me, and thank you to my father-in-law, Mr. Goslin, for that lovely introduction. I paid him to say those nice things about me last Thanksgiving. So today I'd like to talk to you about a leadership issue. And we all want to be as positive in our influence in the organizations we are members of. And so we all want to be positive leaders. We all have the capacity to affect the world in a positive way. But yet we know that unconscious bias is something that exists. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit about unconscious bias, about the research that I've conducted on this, and about a topic that I think is not only important in the future, but extremely important in the present, given the recent events where unconscious bias may have played a role in snap decisions that then have led to a lot of pain and even life and death implications. Now, you may be wondering why a professor of marketing is speaking to you about unconscious bias. It is not because I'm here to market unconscious bias to you. I don't want to sell you on that at all. No, rather, I'd like to start with thinking about who you are authentically. Each of you, each of us, has a unique set of gifts. And the goal is not for us to be into one sort of mold, but to start with who we are authentically, because we are not products. But to think about the ways in which marketers, like the people I deal with often, use strategies, psychological and social, to affect and influence judgment. And that's what I'd like to speak with you about today. because cognitive associations are kind of like a map. In the center of the map is the item of focus. It might be a product, it might be a person. And out of that map are different roads that lead to different associations. And those associations are what affect our choices. And they affect trust, they affect evaluations, and they also affect performance. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit about how that happens. But I'd like to start with an example that might be familiar to you, Corona beer. If you've ever seen or imbibed Corona beer, you may have certain associations when I say Corona beer. What might come to mind? Perhaps some of you might be thinking of Mexico. Some of you might think about a lime. Some of you might think about vacation or relaxation, the beach. In fact, if I asked you to write 5 adjectives that you associate, for instance, with Corona beer, I could predict pretty reliably that the correlation between your answers would be relatively high. There's a reason why that's the case. It's because you've seen regularly imagery that features limes, beach, vacation, Mexico. And so there's been a deliberate management of the associations with Corona beer. Now, if I were to ask you to do the same exercise and generate 5 words, 5 cognitive associations that others would say about you and how you impact them, what would they say? What would you say? Research suggests that there would be 2 differences with this exercise than if I asked you about Corona beer. The first is that it would take a longer time for you to generate that list than it would for you to generate the list about Corona beer. Now think about that. Ostensibly, you know yourself better than you know a beer, hopefully. The second thing to notice about the difference in these 2 exercises is that out of the list of 5, 3 of them are wrong. There's only a 0.4 correlation between the impact we think we're having on others and the impact that we actually do. So when you think about those 5 words that are associated with you and how you affect others, which of the 3 are you willing to walk away from? Which of the 3 are you willing to accept as incorrect? And how can we increase that 0.4 correlation and get it closer to 1? Because authentic leadership is really about aligning the way in which you want to impact others with the way in which you actually impact them. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the science behind all of this. Typically, we think about an iceberg. Now, anyone who's seen the movie Titanic knows the most important thing about an iceberg is that what you see above the surface is the small part, right? And that's just the tip of the iceberg, as the phrase goes, and most of it is beneath the surface. Well, we can think about our minds in the same way. Our conscious minds are able to process about as much as you can see above the surface of the water. Our conscious minds are only able to process as about as much information as can fit on a post-it note. So consciously, you're hearing me say post-it note. You're thinking about unconscious bias, and you're listening to me speak. But like with an iceberg, much of the work goes on beneath the surface. And it's a good thing because our unconscious mind is doing the heavy lifting. It is the supercomputer that allows us to be effective in our daily lives. Your unconscious mind, for instance, that supercomputer allows you to sit here and listen to me without telling yourself, heart, don't forget to beat. Lungs, don't forget to breathe, right? And if you had to do that, you pretty much would have time for nothing else. So it's a good thing. The other thing about this iceberg is that our conscious mind above the surface thinks really quickly. It makes snap judgments. So if I say to you, do you like rats? You don't have to sit and ponder, do I like rats? No, you can have an immediate reaction, and most people's reaction is one of disgust. In fact, disgust is one of our most immediate judgments. But the supercomputer underneath thinks more slowly. So if I ask you, what will your tax refund be this year? You have to think, do a little bit more thinking, right? And you have to think more deliberately. That's the difference between the conscious and the unconscious and thinking fast and thinking slow. And our minds are incredible. Our minds use heuristics. Heuristics are shortcuts that allow us to be much more efficient. It allows you to go to the supermarket, and even though there are 1,000 cereals in the aisle, you don't have to take each box and read each one. Because you see Kellogg's, for example, and you say, oh yeah, Tony the Tiger, I trust that brand, I don't have to read everything. Or in the toothpaste aisle, right? We have more choices than ever. But the thing about these heuristics or these shortcuts that our minds use is that they're prone to bias. In fact, research has suggested that our expectations in going, our biases, are built into these heuristics. So though you're listening to me say heuristic, you're also noticing that I'm a woman. You're also noticing that I'm a woman of color. You may be picking up on whether I have an accent. If you're wondering, I'm from Brooklyn, New York. And all of these other things that you think you're not noticing, but in fact, you are. So one of the things I'd like to mention today is that our goal is not for us to be colorblind, for instance, because it's not achievable. As human beings, we naturally categorize. We walk into a room and we see people that are like us, and we notice people that are not like us. So are we doomed? What do we do? Well, I'd like to talk to you today more about how we can interrupt that fast thinking, interrupt those heuristics, so that we notice difference, but we don't take the extra step in assuming that it's a bad thing. Some examples from research done, for instance, has shown that because of these expectations, people really have different associations. In an experiment where people were randomly assigned to two conditions and asked to do mental problems, math, and vocabulary problems, people who were assigned to the condition where they used a pen with the MIT logo on it said they felt more intelligent than the people assigned randomly to the condition with a blank pen. Same pen, just a different logo. Or another study has shown, for instance, in the case of wine, people randomly assigned to two conditions, the same exact bottle of wine. In one condition, the label said, from France. And then the other condition, the label said, from North Dakota. You know where I'm going with this. People randomly assigned to the condition with the North Dakota wine rated the wine as less delicious. But get this, the food was also rated as less delicious, and the company at the event less charming. So think about that the next time you go and shop for wine for a dinner party. And other research done at MIT with energy drinks, randomly assigning people to a condition where they either had to pay full price or they got a 10% discount because they were at MIT. Now, I don't know about you, but I like a good deal. So 10% discount, who says no to that, right? Well, in those experiments, the people in the 10% discount condition randomly assigned the discount due to an institutional perk, meaning because you were at MIT, not because the product was stale or damaged, led to subsequent running on a treadmill being lower, less effective in the condition where the people had the discounted energy drink. Now, what you're noticing is in common with all of these studies is that perfectly rational people make very irrational choices, and that our expectations affect these judgments. And so the question is, what are the expectations that we have? And how can we take them from the unconscious and make them conscious so that we know when our minds are thinking fast, but also tricking us? This is important if you believe that you live in a meritocracy where people's advancement and their performance is completely correlated with the effort that they put in. Now, this is stuff that is related to unconscious bias, because turns out when people behave in a manner that violates those expectations, they may get penalized for it. And the fancy term for that is role incongruity. When you behave in a way that is different than I expect of your role, it has an impact on my judgment. However, this role incongruity and the penalties associated are greater if you are a woman, or if you are a person of color, or if you are an LGBT person. For example, research has shown that female leaders are given more negative and less positive feedback after the same suggestions and arguments in a discussion. MBAs, master's students, rating a fictional entrepreneur given their resume, same resume, only difference, the top of the resume, the name is either Heidi or Howard, rated both Heidi and Howard as competent, but Heidi is seen as selfish and not the type of person you would hire or want to work for. Studies have shown that in the workplace, when women have children, they're put on the sort of sidelines and viewed as mom, Whereas men, when they become fathers in the workplace, boy, he was competent before, but now he's also really a kind person, a great dad. And you may have heard about research with resumes where people were given the same exact resume, but in some conditions, the name on the resume had an African-American sounding name, and in the others, not, and lower hiring rates for resumes with black names. This has also been replicated for applicants with LGBT identifiers on their resumes. Now, I'm not here to tell you that the dominant group needs to do all the work, because there's work to be done. But this can also be internalized. And we need to interrupt things like the confidence gap. Because women and people of color, for instance, are also presented with these images and can internalize them. For instance, after a science test where no one had any preparation or were aware of the topics, having no knowledge of how they'd perform, female and male participants were asked to participate in a competition following the test. Only 49% of the women signed up to participate, whereas 71% of the men did. Now, when I was growing up in New York, the lottery, the tagline, the advertising was, you have to be in it to win it. But if you don't think that you deserve to be in it, how can you win it? A study at Hewlett-Packard, for instance, showed that women feel in order to apply for a promotion, they need to have 100% of the qualifications. Men, 60%. Confidence is essential to building competence. But that confidence is built or undermined at a very early age. You may be familiar with the Dahl test. The Dahl test is research that was done in the 1950s that was presented for Brown versus Board of Education, which led to the desegregation of schools in the United States. Children as young as 2 and 3 years old in the Dahl test are presented with two dolls, a white doll and a black doll. These are black children, mind you. And these 2 and 3 year old children, when presented the white doll and the black doll, are asked a series of questions. Which is the smart doll? And they point to the white doll. Which is the pretty doll? And they point to the white doll. Which is the nice doll? And they point to the white doll. And when asked why, these children, though barely verbal, say, because she's white. And then when asked, which doll looks more like you, they point to the black doll. This is very early, embedded very early in our minds. And if there is such a deluge of imagery and influence that leads even children who've only been on this earth for 2 years to think this way, there's no wonder why we as adults have to be deliberate and conscious in combating unconscious bias. So I'd like to share with you some research that I've done at MIT to look at how bias affects performance. Let's suspend disbelief and imagine that you want to become even more intelligent than you already are. I know, it's not possible, but let's suspend disbelief and say you want to boost your cognitive ability, right? And you decide that you want to buy a product to aid you in this goal. Now, there are real products on the market that purport to do this, right? One is called BrainAge. It's a concentration training. You may have also seen advertised on television, Lumosity, which basically what these things do is they make you do some mental calisthenics to sort of develop your brain by doing puzzles, mathematical and verbal puzzles. So we thought to ourselves, gee, these expectations are having these placebo effects, where if I think French wine is more delicious, it tastes better to me. Or if I think MIT people are smarter, when I use an MIT pen, I feel smarter. Can we see this with regard to performance? So we did experiments where we had people use a real BrainAge product, which was developed by neuroscientists, and we randomly assigned people to two conditions. In one condition, they trained with the product that was created for MIT students. And in the other, they trained with the product that was created for the University of Phoenix, the online university. Now, if you've been paying attention, then you know that placebo effects, like with the wine, like with the pen, like with the price discount, may give you a certain inkling as to what we found. But here's the thing. We had people use the product, train with it, and then we tested them. And what we found were reverse placebo effects, meaning that even though they used the same exact product, they performed significantly worse when using the one for MIT. So we thought to ourselves, well, gee, that's embarrassing. Because we were at MIT. And we thought, well, maybe people don't think the way we do. Maybe we are, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid kind of a thing. So we did a pretest on a separate group, and we asked them to rate the prestige of the two schools. And perhaps consistent with your expectations, people rated MIT as more prestigious than the University of Phoenix. Not controversial. And then we thought, well, gee, maybe the expectations about the efficacy of the product were different than we'd expected. No. The people believed that the MIT product was expected to work better. So it was really interesting to find these results, especially because although they performed worse in the MIT condition, they were willing to pay 35% more for it. That's a lot of money. So we looked into some alternative explanations. The amount of effort expended was the same, both reported as well as the amount of time spent. So it's not like they're working more diligently or less diligently in one of the other conditions. So we scratched our heads, and you should have seen the dean of MIT's face when I presented this research to him. And we went back and decided to do another study. And this time we did it with language learning. And we decided to do it with a fictional language. We wanted to make sure, hey, maybe it turns out, even though we did random assignment, the people in the University of Phoenix condition were incredible crossword puzzle folks, the type who do the New York Times crossword on Sunday in ink. So we did it again with language learning software, and this time we used a fictional language, actually, from a movie called Avatar, which is a movie about blue aliens that have their own language. And this may not shock you, my postdoctoral researcher is fluent in this language, called Navi, and was able to develop a language learning program for this fictional Navi language. I should let you know that none of our participants knew Navi in going. I don't know if any of you are fluent in it. I certainly was not and still am not. But we created essentially a Rosetta Stone type product for learning a fictional language, just to make sure that, you know, there was no sort of tipping the scale towards someone who had learned French, let's say, at home. And so we did it again, and we randomly assigned people to these conditions, and once again, MIT or University of Phoenix. I should mention that this was a between subjects design, which means that if you were in the MIT condition, you were unaware of the University of Phoenix condition, and vice versa. Okay, so what happened? Once again, the participants in the MIT condition performed significantly worse. But here's the thing, though that was their objective result, their subjective results were really in the opposite direction. They said in the MIT condition, though they performed worse, they felt better prepared. And once again, they had a higher willingness to pay for the product. So here we have rational people, and they are being trained, and no one has a leg up on the topic, and yet they think that they're better prepared, and they're willing to pay more money for something that leads them to perform worse. Why? The fact is that when we are in an organization or in an area where there are high standards, and for your job, for your church, for any organization in which you might be part, if there are high standards in this organization, there's a process that goes on called social comparison. Remember earlier when I said we can't help ourselves? We can't help ourselves but think, how do I fit here? And we generate, with the help of the communications from our organizations, with the help of the faces that we see of the leadership, with the help of the faces that we see around us, we generate reference points as a prototypical symbol of the organization. Now, if that symbol is psychologically close to you, the effect is that you assimilate toward that high standard. But if that symbol is psychologically distant from you, meaning this isn't a place for people like me, This is a place for people like them. What you experience are called contrast effects, and you contrast away from that standard. This result is more acute for people who are high self-monitors. That means people who are really concerned about what other people think about them. And if you're the first or only woman in an organization, or the first or only person of color, or the first or only LGBT person or immigrant, you're probably going to engage in high self-monitoring. This effect is also more acute as the task becomes more difficult. And in competitive settings, that's usually the name of the game. So, how can we combat this effect? The first thing is changing that reference group, not lowering the standards, keeping the standards high, but expanding that focal point so that other people believe that they belong there too. We replicated our experiments, and we made one difference with MIT students. We had people do this experiment, and either we put them into a condition where a fellow student who was like them was at MIT and doing very, very well, and then everything else was the same, the training and the test, or a fellow student like them was at MIT and was struggling and doing poorly, and everything else was the same, the training and the test. And what we found was that when people were given a focal point similar to them that was doing well, they assimilated toward that high standard. Their test results were through the roof. And when they were given a psychologically close person who was doing poorly, meaning they were distant from the standards of MIT, we saw lower performance amongst those people. Even though these were all MIT students, they were randomly assigned. So high standards without inclusivity lead to intimidation and contrast effects. And that's important because organizations oftentimes focus too much on numbers. We have X percent of women or X percent of people of color. But the attrition rates for these people will be higher if once they join the organization, they're not empowered or included in the focal point. You cannot succeed in an organization with high standards if you believe that the reference group excludes you. So, what do? We become more mindful. We become more aware of these processes so that we can combat them. We become mindful leaders to positively impact the world around us. Mindfulness is a concept that comes out of the meditative school, and I'm not going to ask us to have a group meditation session here, but one principle that's really important is really maximizing the moment and not letting the mistakes of the past or the fears of the future bog you down. Thinking, what can I do now to really make this moment most impactful? What you can do now, today. Now, I'm a professor, so I'm giving you guys homework, right? Your first homework assignment, make the unconscious conscious. These heuristics that we use are prone to bias. But here's the thing. The minute you take them from the unconscious and make them conscious, they just don't work that way anymore. For example, one heuristic or one cognitive bias is called anchoring. When we see a number in our vicinity, we tend to stick to that number and insufficiently adjust away from it. So if I ask a group, did Mahatma Gandhi live beyond age 140? This is the easiest pop quiz, by the way. The answer obviously is no. The probability of any human being living beyond age 140 is virtually zero. Now, the average answer for that question of how old was Mahatma Gandhi when he did in fact die is 67, when preceded by that question, did he live beyond age 140? But if you ask the question, did Mahatma Gandhi live beyond the age of 9? Second easy pop question, yes, of course he did. We've all seen pictures of him as an adult. When asked that same follow-up question, how old was he then when he died? the mean response goes down by 10 years to 57. That's how unconscious bias works. We anchor, for instance, on a number, and we insufficiently adjust. I guarantee you, though, now that you know that anchoring exists, if I ask you how old Mahatma Gandhi was when he died, even though you don't know the exact answer, you'll be less prone to have the bias based on the number preceding. Another bias is that familiarity leads to liking. We've all heard a song for the first time and you're thinking, that song is terrible. But then after hearing it drummed into your head by the radio stations, you find yourself singing along and you're like, oh, they got me. Familiarity leads to liking. And because of that, when we hire people, work with people, we engage in something called cultural matching. We say, you know, that Jim, he reminds me of me when I was younger. What we're doing is cultural matching. And so it's no surprise then why this tends to replicate itself in hiring practices when it comes to evaluations of how people are performing and judgments that we think are rational. The second thing I want a bit of homework I want to leave you with is get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Talking about bias is not easy. And I'll tell you, I'm not immune to it either. I myself am prone to unconscious bias. We all are. We are human beings and are socialized from a very, very young age. Because of that, wishing it away doesn't work. Being too uncomfortable to address it doesn't help. You've got to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Research suggests, for instance, that people who are in more diverse organizations have better performance. A colleague of mine did research on this with regard to people doing a pricing exercise for financial markets. Turns out that when people are randomly assigned to two groups, one that's diverse and one that's homogenous, in the diverse group, people feel a little bit more comfortable at the beginning. It's more comfortable to see people and interact with people with whom you have much in common. But in terms of their final performance, the diverse markets had a higher degree of accuracy than the homogenous markets to a significant level. Which means that getting comfortable with being uncomfortable is a skill that we must all develop. In this past week, we've had some really uncomfortable and tragic circumstances. And many people have wondered, what can I do? How can I help? I feel so bad, but I don't know what to do. Having the uncomfortable conversations is something you can do to help and to become an ally for impact. And that's the other thing I'd like to leave you with. Becoming an ally is a job. It's work. It's not something that you can do passively. And you have to actively pick it up because there are institutionalized and unconscious biases that are actively operating that we need to be mindful and deliberate to combat. All of these things are affecting our judgments, and all of these things are within our grasp to change. If you've never engaged in improv, I highly suggest you do that. You'll feel like a fool the first time you do it because you're asked to do something really silly, like plan a trip to the planet Pluto. Or is it even a planet anymore? But here's the thing about improv. In improv, the rules are you have to say yes and you can't say no but. You have to be active in your listening. How many people have been thinking about what they were going to say while someone else was speaking in a conversation? Yes, all of us. In improv, you just gotta go with it, you gotta take that pressure, and you gotta build trust early, and you gotta jump in and volunteer. Those are the rules of improv, but it turns out those are also traits of great leaders. Combating unconscious bias is an active participant activity. And if you practice things like improv, you can become more comfortable with being uncomfortable. Lastly, I'd like to say, use the power of narrative to great effect in building bridges with people of different backgrounds. Each of you has a personal narrative, and I don't mean a narrative about why you're great and all the things you've achieved. Each of you has overcome a challenge. Each human being can connect on that. If we can develop empathy, we can view one another past the thin slicing that we do in looking at people's exteriors and really connect with them as humans. I'd like to leave you with my favorite Gandhi quote, which I think speaks to the fact that you need to actually align the way you want to improve and impact others with the way in which you actually do. And he said, "Happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony." If we can be mindful in combating unconscious bias, I do believe that we can be more effective leaders, we can be happier people, and we can live in a happier world. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Goslin, for your insights.
Thank you.
This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio.